I'm excited to be with you this morning. I've made several different trips to Lubbock over the last year and a half, and I'm really excited to share. I'm excited to share because this is a passion, and this is where God has led me for the last 20 years. And there's many things that I've seen done well. There's many things that I've seen people struggle with. There's many things that I wish I would have known before I started. And so that's what this morning's about, is about sharing that. But first, I need to share something with you. I need to share about my daughter, Anna. This is my oldest daughter, Anna. She's 19 years old. She's currently in Montana doing a missions gap year program. But this is her with her state-winning 4-H cake in cakes. So when she was about 8 years old in the state of Indiana, what happens every August is the Indiana State Fair. And leading up to that is every county in the state has their own county fair. And when she was about 8 years old, we're walking through the cake decorations at the Indiana State Fair. And we're talking about the cakes, and she's just absolutely awed by the cakes that she saw decorated. And that year she started playing with cake decorating and getting tools and different things. Over the next couple of years, she keeps looking at the cakes, but she's advancing in her skills. And so she's like, "I don't think I ever could get there, Dad." And I said, "Yes, you actually have all the talent and the skill and the mindset already to go there." So at age, that would have been 12, she entered the advanced cakes at the local 4-H fair. Advanced cakes are typically the high school cakes, and they're typically all fondant driven or decorated in that way. And so she entered at age 12 into the competition that usually starts for 14, 15-year-olds. She won that year the advanced cakes at our county fair. And that's actually the cake on the left. That's her Narnia cake that she made at 12 years old. And so she went through the county and up to the state fair. She was one of 11 kids that year that got a blue ribbon and honors, which is the highest you can get without winning grand champion at the state fair at age 12. She subsequently went on the next few years. She won the county grand championship 5 years in a row. And the second to last year, before she wrapped up, COVID kind of derailed some things. But she made the cake on the very far right, which she won the grand championship at the state fair. Pretty amazing opportunity for this young lady. Age 16 when she wins the Indiana State Fair with a grand champion cake. She did this because she spent, I think on the last cake, she spent over 120 hours making that cake. And it's a work of art as anything. Now, how many of you in the room would want her to make you a cake, right? Yeah, everybody, right? Even though you have no idea how it tastes, right? You would love to have that cake. How many of you think she can make cakes that taste awesome? Okay, well then you don't know 4-H cake decorating very well, because those are all styrofoam forms underneath the fondant. She does make amazing cakes and they taste great. She's made several wedding cakes over the last year. She did three this year. And within that, there's always the right ingredients, right? It can look great on the outside, but if it tastes awful on the inside, nobody's going to want your cake, right? It takes the right ingredients to be able to do it right. And it reminded me of the fact that about Hannah's 19, it was probably before she was born, my wife and I were getting ready to go out of town with my in-laws on a little day trip on a Saturday. And that day trip, we got up. I think we were going off to go hiking. my wife got up and she made a coffee cake. You know, wonderful. You know, we could take it in the car, eat it along the way to where we were going to hike. Well, within that, there's obviously specific ingredients that you need for the coffee cake. And one of those is sugar. Now, those who bake, what looks a lot like sugar? Salt. Yes, so we get about an hour down the road and everybody takes out the coffee cake and we're getting ready to eat it. And all of a sudden, we all gag. Because she grabbed the salt instead of the sugar. That is what fundraising's like. That is what it takes in the challenge. You have to have the right ingredients. You have to have the time and effort to put into it. And you have to, one, look good on the outside, but two, be able to know what you need to know. And three, minimize mistakes. Right? You know, fundraising is all about risk, but calculated risk. But mistakes happen, but the biggest deficit that I've seen and the biggest obstacle in ministry and the ministry of fundraising, which really is a ministry, is those obstacles and those mistakes. What people don't really understand is how things are perceived and how things are done and the mistakes that are made. And some are very simple mistakes, and some are very big mistakes. And so this morning, we're going to start talking first off about those mistakes and those obstacles that you kind of can avoid as you go through this season of fundraising and where God is leading you. So the first one is looking like you're 1980 in 2021. Now, for those of you who are younger in the crowd, you may go, that'll never happen. But there is that whole mindset of branding and marketing to what you do in fundraising. For the last 15 years, I've invested as much time in branding and marketing as I have in fundraising. Partially because that is the story that you tell to those who are in front of you. And if you don't tell the story in a way that is concise and consistent, as well as you look like you're professional and you know what you're doing. As those of you who are considering going in, out into parachurch ministry or nonprofit work or missions, this is utmost priority for you. Because you need to be able to understand the communication tools that you need, that you utilize, but also what branding actually means and understands. And this isn't going to be a whole morning about branding. This is more about the fact that branding makes a difference in fundraising. And when you have people that say, oh yeah, this is a great mission work, or this is a great nonprofit work, and when you click on their website, you can't find any information. And when you don't get a newsletter for 3 months or 4 months or 5 months or 6 months or 9 months, and those that serve on mission teams understand this. If they don't hear from you, if they don't understand what you're saying, if it's consistently the message is changing, it's a big mistake. 23% on average is a brand increased revenue. So from that very stat, you can say as a fundraiser, in my world, that if I'm consistent in our brand, in our communication, in the styles and what we utilize, our revenue will be 23% more on average. That's a big deal. Who wants to raise 25% more because you consistently tell the story well? You consistently use the right colors and the right messages well, that you stay consistent in what you say and do, and that you're not all over the map. You know, for us, when I stepped into NAMI Congo a year ago, we had a newsletter that looked like it was in 1980. We had inconsistency in branding. And our marketing materials and our website, we were in the process of changing it. but it's a big deal to be able to communicate, because your message is not competing against other missionaries. Your communication and your branding has to look like the rest of the world. Coca-Cola uses one color code for all their Coca-Cola signs. Why are you changing the color on your logo every time you turn around and you have no consistency in what you're doing? 23% increase in revenue just over branding consistency. Every fundraiser in every situation, whether it's with a university, LCU, you will see the same branding throughout LCU. When you see an LCU logo, you know it's LCU, right? And that's what has to happen with your brand, with your mission work. And that can be as simple as your email newsletter when you're serving on the field and staying consistent with your donors, or making sure you understand your core values and continually repeating your core values as you work through your mission. 94% of consumers say they're likely to be loyal to a brand that offers complete transparency. People are loyal to those who are transparent. And that comes first with your branding, but also with your communication and how you handle things. So from a mistakes in fundraising, not being transparent in how you handle your finances, how you handle all types of situations, will affect your fundraising efforts. If people don't know that you're transparent, if they always have questions about what you're doing or what you're communicating, and wait a minute, this month you said you're starting this program, and next month you say you're starting this program, but they sound like the same program, that drives down the effectiveness of your communications and your branding and your marketing, because you're not staying consistent. One of the things that I've always driven for in every organization I've served with is the first thing I do is come in and say, okay, you said these are all the things that we do. There's 10 different areas of what we do. For branding purposes, we need to get that to 4. What does that look like, and how do we communicate that as 4 areas? Because in 4 areas, I can give you an elevator speech about what we do and how we do it in a matter of 3 minutes and be able to concisely and consistently communicate it, because I know that people are going to stay on board with us if I can clearly communicate that. 64% of consumers say that shared values are the main reason that they have a trusted relationship with a brand. Shared values. So from that standpoint, what does your brand and your communications mean to those who you are working with? If you're not consistently engaging them in how you do what you do and being able to stay on board with that in the shared values category, you know, there is mission drift, is what we call this. If you don't have shared values with those who you are working with and those who you are communicating with, and you can't communicate that across the board, then you're going to struggle with that area. 65% of people that feel an emotional connection to a brand say that it's because they care about people like me. The biggest question with social media these days and fundraising is, how do you show that you actually care about those who you're communicating with? And how do you connect with them in a virtual world? That's the harder part of what we have to try to do as people who are part of fundraising and brands. Branding is corporate, but it's also nonprofit in its ministry. It goes for local churches here in the community. It goes for other nonprofits, that you actually care about your donors, that you communicate that you care about your donors. The first thing I do is usually change our receipt process for our letter writing on a monthly basis. Because what I've tried to do is communicate that we care about the donor, we care about who they are and what they're engaged in, as well as being able to communicate that through regular communication, whether that's our email newsletter, whether that's our written receipt letter every month, is that we know who they are and why they matter to us. 45% of consumers will unfollow a brand if their activity is dominated by self-promotion. You can't look at yourself all the time and think that people want to hear only about what is focused in on you. And, you know, I take time with branding and I take time with communications because it can't be self-promotion 100% of the time. It's hard when you're working out there in the field or with nonprofits to not continually point to yourself. But one of the things that you can do as you go out is if you have volunteers that are working alongside you, start to highlight your volunteers. Start to highlight what they do and how they invest in the ministry. That's something as over the last year, as I've worked through this series of coming back out to present this material, it's been a couple of years, and putting it all together, I realized that for me, this is one of those convicting statements. You know, we haven't highlighted our board members this last year, what their contributions are, or other volunteers that have been involved with us. We have at different points in times as a ministry, but that's been something that when I start to look at this, it's been very self-promoting in the last year. And that was strategic because we needed to improve our communications overall and get into rhythm with our brand and how we handle things. But it's part of that essence of being able to thank donors, to thank those who step forward with what's happening with your mission work or your ministry work. 80% of people cite authenticity of content. It has to look real. Yeah, that's the hard part sometimes, is because of what's happening in your own local world and what's happening in your ministry overseas, it's oftentimes I just got to get the job done. You know, I talked to Ben and Ryan and Eric when I first started with the mission work that I'm with now at Nami Congo in Malawi, and their writing of articles for the newsletter had gotten to a point where they weren't passionate, and it was just something that had to get done. You know, and it was a struggle. It was a struggle for each one of them because they weren't inspired by how we were presenting it to donors, how we were sharing it to donors, our branding of it, and it just became a routine of, I've got to give a short update, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. And it became not a storytelling model as much as it became just a routine. And it became unauthentic in a lot of ways, where the authenticity of what they were sharing just didn't work because it wasn't real. It wasn't a story. It wasn't communicated well in that way. The bottom line in this area is that consistency and content matter most with your branding and communications. This is probably the number one mistake that I see in mission work and nonprofit work. Not looking like you know what you're doing, not taking the time to really communicate well. You have to spend time and effort to consistently present good content to those who are supporting you. You have to be transparent. You have to be authentic, right? You have to do all these different components. So one, your branding looks good and you're able to communicate. But two, you're able to engage donors. You know, if you're not able to do that, then you're not going to get very far. You know, I hear from mission teams all over the country over the last 20 years, the number one thing is I don't get reports from our missionaries, right? We've got people that served on mission boards before. We don't hear from our missionaries. Or the last update was all about them, had nothing to do with the work that they were doing in XYZ country. Like, I hear that more and more from mission teams and from donors. It's like, I know what's happening with their family, but I have no idea when's the last time they baptized somebody or what they're really doing for discipleship right now. There's just no consistency in how they communicate. And so really working towards those core components of understanding your core values, making sure you're consistent on your branding, as well as consistent with your communication. If you're putting out a newsletter in January and you're not putting out another newsletter till November, where's everybody at in the process? And so that consistency in your communication matters most in this time. And it's the biggest obstacle that most people face. You know, my daughter that I mentioned earlier, Anna, she's doing a missions gap year right now. She's in Montana. She's about three-fourths of the way supported with her work. So she's still working on support for this year. The hardest thing is, because her schedule is so busy, is making sure she sets down and communicates with those who are currently supporting her and those who she still needs to raise funds from. And you have to make this number one priority beyond your relationship with God and your work in the field. Your third component has to be communications and branding consistency, and how to tell the story. Now, with that, one of the other biggest obstacles in the fundraising world and missions fundraising is that you're a great public relations person. Why would that be a bad thing? Why would that be a bad thing? Anybody got an answer?
Make it about yourself too much? Or...
That can be the case. That can be the case. Anybody else? Great public relations people don't ask for money. One of the biggest failures in the ministry fundraising world is you don't actually ask. You're really good at presenting the work. You're really good at, you know, going to coffee and having lunch with people, which is all my father-in-law thinks that I do, okay? You know, if you end up in the world of ministry fundraising, your office assistant will say, oh, that's for a meal, that's for a meal, that's for a meal when you're receding. We did that yesterday. You know, they think that all you do is go to coffee and lunch. And and great public relations people are needed, like especially for a university and bigger institutions. You know, you need people that can connect with people. And you, as a person who is in the ministry fundraising world, needs to connect with people. But you also need to ask. I've had some great people I've known that haven't been able to ask. So Millard Fuller says, I have tried raising money by asking for it, and by not asking for it, I always get more by asking for it. You know, it's pretty simple. You have not because you ask not, right? And that's, for some people, really, really hard. Who's ever raised support for a short-term trip or for some mission work that you've done? A few of you. Yeah, asking people to support you is really hard, right? Yeah, it is. And we'll go through part of that today to discuss that. But you need to be able to ask, because if not, you're not going to have the funds that you need. So one of my greatest history heroes is George Mueller. Does anybody know the name George Mueller? You studied him in school? Sean does. He doesn't count. So George Mueller was a pastor in England who started the first orphanages across all of England. So is known for his work in orphan care. An amazing man of God and some amazing stories. But why it's known as the Mueller effect is because of this story. I'll tell you this. This is from his very own words. It says, the children are dressed and ready for school, but there's no food for them to eat. The house mother of the orphanage informed George Mueller. George asked her to take the 300 children in the dining room and have them sit at the tables. He thanked God for the food and waited. George knew God would provide food for the children as he always did. Within minutes, a baker knocked on the door. Mr. Mueller, he said, last night I could not sleep. Somehow I knew you would need bread this morning. I got up and baked 3 batches for you. I will bring it in. Soon there was another knock at the door. It was the milkman. His cart had broken down in front of the orphanage. The milk would spoil by the time the wheel was fixed. He asked George if he could use some free milk. George smiled as the milkman brought in 10 large cans of milk. It was just enough to feed the 300 thirsty children. I've seen this in reality. In a VBS about 10 years ago in Haiti, when we had 400 kids show up the last day and we prepared for about 200 kids for food. And as we kept scooping out of the big ladle and dumping it on plates, you know, a few of us gathered in the corner to pray because we just knew we didn't have enough food. Like, we didn't prepare enough food for 400 kids. And every kid walked out of that VBS that day fed. Food on plates, more food than what could be provided. Truly biblical stories, you know. But George Mueller is known as kind of the godfather of prayer resourcing, right? That his whole focus was he did not go ask businessmen in England for money. He did not go out and would he share sometimes what the need was? Yeah. But he never asked. And he became this model for a lot of people about prayer as a resource to provide everything you need. And we know that in many ways that as we pray, that is a way that God can answer that. But we also know that that's not the only way that God answers that. And from that very standpoint, you know, if you know, I was reading through different things because I've spent many years thinking through this, and you know, there's biblical example of people going into different villages and asking the churches to come alongside and provide for their needs as they go and as they minister. So there's nothing that makes George Mueller and this model the only model. It doesn't make it scriptural that, you know, that if you have a need that all you do is pray and then it'll show up. There are scriptures that say that, and there are scriptures that show that, but there's also scriptures that show the very opposite of where you are to ask fellow believers to come alongside you. So for somebody to come along and say, well, and it's always comes out in this fact. It's the GWP line item on your budget. The God will provide line item, right? But there truly is this model where people don't want to ask. People just are stuck. Like, they can really do a nice job with sharing about, but they literally just won't ask. And I will tell you from working with donors for the last 20 years, there's donors that are waiting to be asked. They want to be asked. They need to be asked. That's how their generosity works. They want to be able to be asked to engage in what God's doing. And the Mueller effect happens, but also just the fact of freezing in that moment of what is happening. So some people go, well, why should I ask? You know, why should I take that risk? Why should I engage in the ministry of fundraising and asking people for money? My wife thinks that what I do is strange because she could never do it. She's gifted in so many different ways, but asking people to help and asking for people to give resources is not in her DNA. And so when we show up at churches or we show up at donors' homes, it's the oddball out thing, right? But why should we ask? You know, that's the big question. It honors the donor and your relationship. You know, if you go in and just present the work and you don't ask them to participate, to engage, you know, the number one thing you should be asking for, and we'll cover this later, but is for prayer for your work, right? But also you shouldn't ask them to give because it honors your relationship with that donor and encourages them to engage in what is happening with their mission work. It challenges their relationship with God and their resources. You know, those who have a heart for generosity, but also those who are kind of borderline. You know, every time I step into a room where I sit down with a donor and we get ready to have the conversation that I know has been leading up to this conversation, you know, this we'll go through the ask later and how that works. But every time I do this, I know that when I ask Bob to step forward with a $20,000 gift for this project, that it's not myself asking for me, but it's God asking Bob to step forward with the resources that he has. That I'm a vehicle for God in this process. That if he rejects me, it's not me, and he has to walk through this process of God has given me X, Y, Z. And now God has asked me to step into his work and give it away. And so that's personally between Bob and God. The best part about doing fundraising as a ministry is the fact that you get the opportunity to ask Bob to step forward in his relationship with God. This doesn't happen on the first meeting. It doesn't happen on the second meeting, possibly. This is a long-term relationship, you know. And so from that standpoint, there are times where, and we'll talk about this upcoming, but you're a vehicle for God. For those who do this from a secular standpoint, in fundraising and development, I don't understand. I literally don't. You know, I've been a Christ follower for 25 years. I've been doing this type of ministry for 20 years. I know the motivation in my heart is to help people step forward with where they're at in their relationship with God. You see it throughout Scripture of different scenarios of people being asked to step forward. And that's what my role is as a part of this ministry fundraising world, is to ask people to step forward and step into where God's called them to. And lastly, it's not about you. You know, that's the hardest part. You know, when you're doing the work of the Lord, and whether it's being a local pastor or whether it's being a student, you know, this isn't about you. This is about what God is trying to accomplish through you and through the mission work. And you have to take the focus off yourself when you sit down to ask people to engage in God's work. If you don't like hearing no, or not yet, or Cameron, thanks, we'll get back to you, and they never call you back. If you can't handle that type of pressure, and we'll go through personality giving later, and those who have studied the Enneagram will get a good feel about why this affects you, then maybe fundraising's not for you as a full-time ministry. Or maybe it's going to be the hardest thing you do in your full-time ministry. But it's not about who you are. It's about what God's doing with the donor. So, with that, we're done with session one. So, questions that I can answer before we take a short break and get ready for session two. Well, we'll let you finish your coffee and wake up a little bit more. And we won't talk about as many statistics in the second session. But stop by. We'll take 10 minutes now if you need a break. Drink too much coffee.
Restrooms are right outside the door to the left. Water or other things are across the hallway. Thank you. 10 minutes.
For more content like this, go to lcu.edu.